If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us this beautiful, lovely, sunshiny Saturday. Appreciate you sharing part of your weekend with me. My friends, there's a lot to get to today on the Business Lunch show. We're going to be talking about that soda tax that just passed in Philadelphia and what that could mean for other big cities around the nation. And we're going to be talking about some new Chicago executives that have all kind of come in the last year, and we're going to be checking in to see how they're doing, what's new, and all that good stuff. But first, we have a very special guest with us in studio. Jason Bauman is here. He is the honcho over at Boxless Media, and he's created a new Chicago social media conference that is on its way to Chicago just days from now. Well, weeks, let's say. But it's on its way here, and it's really shaping up to be a great conference, and it's coinciding with Social Media Day, which is June 30th. I don't know if you celebrate that and take the day off of work and do all the things you're supposed to do on that day, but nonetheless, it's going to be an even bigger deal this year in Chicago. And so here to talk about that with us, welcome to the program, Jason.
Thank you, Amy, so much. We celebrate. We have big parties at the office.
As well, you should. Absolutely. It sounds like you're kind of living social media. So tell us about this conference and how it came to be.
Sure. So, we're a Chicago-based company, Boxless Media, and so we're here in the heart of Chicago. We love Chicago, and we're looking at all these different conferences around the country, and we think, we need one of these here in Chicago, so we need to celebrate in Chicago. You know, more and more social media day celebrations are happening in San Diego and Denver, and still nothing in Chicago, so I said, we're going to do this. We need to grab some of the talent from across the country, bring them to Chicago for a day, and just celebrate social media and how we can grow and use social media more effectively.
And so break down the elements of the conference, because I got rather excited about it when I heard and started knocking on the door. So I'll be involved in that a little bit too. But tell us about some of the other people. People don't need to know about me. They know me.
Sure.
Tell us about the others.
So the overarching theme for the day is building community online. So our keynote speaker is Sue B. Zimmerman. Sue is really known in the business world as one of
the Instagram lady.
Instagram queen of the world. So she's coming out. She's our keynote speaker. She's not really talking about Instagram. She's actually a very successful entrepreneur. So she's built, I think, about 16 or 18 businesses using social media. So she is our keynote speaker. She's awesome. She's super energetic. She gives a great presentation. She pops over here every so often, so it's good to see her back in Chicago. Vivica Von Rosen is one of my favorites. She's a LinkedIn – I call her the LinkedIn queen of the universe. But really, in terms of LinkedIn marketing, she was one of the first people to really step up. And she's kind of remained in that position as a really thought leader in that industry. So she's exciting. She's going to be talking about it. And then we've got Amy Schmittauer, who's a YouTube marketing genius. She's always on YouTube. You know, you check her videos every day. She's talking about how you can build an audience on YouTube. Vincenzo Landino, he's a live streamer. So that whole Facebook Live thing that's popping up right now, Periscope, Meerkat, all those things. Vincenzo is all about that, and he's going to be talking about live streaming. And one of my favorite, what I call digital marketing generalists, is this guy named Rich Brooks. He's from the beautiful Portland, Maine, and he's coming all the way to Chicago. Hasn't been here, I think, in like 10 years, and he's come to talk about just the future of search, social, and mobile marketing. So it's going to be a really exciting day. I'm talking about online reviews. That's kind of my passion in life. So you're going to be there. I can't wait to hear your presentation. So it's really a lot of talent in one room sharing a lot of great information.
And it's going to be at the Moonlight Studios. Again, that's June 30th, 1446 West Kinzie. How can people follow along? How can people attend? And if they can't attend, how can they? Is there a live stream, or is it going to be live tweeted or anything like that?
Absolutely. So I recommend you just checking out the hashtag, which is ChicagoSocial16. Just check out that hashtag, because everyone there is going to have their cell phone in their hands. They're all going to be tweeting. They're all going to be sharing, live streaming. Some of these conferences discourage live streaming, which I think is kind of crazy, because that's part of social media. So why don't we share that information? So we will be live streaming. Check out that you know, that hashtag. But you can also go to ChicagoSocialCon.com, and all the information is there. We do have a digital pass, so if you can't be there, you can get all of the content from that day available on the website after the conference. And right now, if you use the promo code June50, the digital pass is only $27. So it's an amazing value. And, you know, to get all that content for $27, that's nothing. That's like five coffees.
Right. That's a pretty good deal. And so why did you settle on the theme of building community for this year's conference?
You know, it happened because I have all these clients who come to me and say, well, how many times do we get for this amount of money? Will you post six posts a day for this, and that just is completely missing the boat. And social media and digital marketing is about building relationships, you know, and you're talking about building relationships from a really human approach. And I think that's what a lot of people miss. So that concept of building a community, creating new customers or prospective customers or building those relationships is the most important. It's the social and social media. So that's why I really wanted to focus in on that. And we've kind of gathered the people who can talk to that very well. And so it's really shaped up to be a very cool conference.
It seems like you have pretty much all the different platforms represented pretty well. So no matter what your area of interest is, it seems like someone there can speak to it.
We kind of skipped Facebook and Twitter. And the reason why we did that is because, you know, I think of all of the platforms, at least Facebook, everyone knows Facebook and everyone knows how to use Facebook.
Right.
But how do you use YouTube? Or, you know, YouTube is so easy now, and you can use your iPhones or your Android phones to create amazing videos. So why can't we jump on that? So Amy's talking about this. The whole concept of live streaming is new, and all the power we need for that is in our hand, in our cell phones. So I wanted to really get some of the things that people might not know firsthand and offer that education to them.
It's going to be great. It's again, that's June 30th, Moonlight Studios, 1446 West Kinzie. And for people who are attending, so you want them to use their phones, you want them to stream, you want them
Absolutely.
To do live tweet, do all of those things. What should people bring with them or prepare or be prepared to do once they're at the conference?
Bring their phones and be prepared to talk and share, because I really want them to, this is a day to celebrate social media, to celebrate the community, which is just as important. You know, we're celebrating social media, but we're also celebrating Chicago and the amazing people, the amazing companies that are here. We only hope to grow this event in bigger and bigger, bigger ways every year. We want it to be a celebration of social media, but also of the social media community here in Chicago. So bring business cards, bring your phone, be ready to share, and both share in person and share online and get a lot out of this event.
And it's day long, and so there'll be food and stuff going on. There's lots
Absolutely.
To do. It sounds like you will not be bored or hungry at the thing.
Maybe even stuffed food.
Maybe even that. Okay. All right. So everybody, head to follow the hashtag ChicagoSocial16 to know more about it, or head to ChicagoSocialCon, short for conference.com. And you can read all about this event, find out how to get tickets for the June 30th event at Moonlight Studios. Jason Bauman, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for being at the conference.
Gladly. I'll see everybody there. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we are talking about the new soda tax that has just passed in Philly and what that could mean for other cities. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your weekend with me. I super appreciate it. I hope you are enjoying some of that lovely sunshine out there today. Lots to do still here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. My friends, there was a survey released very recently that is really interesting and is all about housing affordability. This was done with Heart Research, and the MacArthur Foundation in Chicago got together to work on this. And it made a lot of headlines this week, really, because it reveals a lot about Chicagoans really struggling to afford their housing. And so here to talk with us about that is Corey Hunt, VP at Heart Research. Hi, Corey. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Amy. Thanks so much for having me.
Certainly. Well, we'll talk us through this survey and what the findings were specifically around housing affordability in Chicago.
Okay. Well, we have been working with the MacArthur Foundation for the past 4 years, tracking public opinion nationally about housing and learning about the people's personal experiences with housing. And this was the first year that we looked locally in the city of Chicago to see what's happening in a major U.S. city on this really important issue. And what we find is that the housing crisis has hit the city of Chicago especially hard. Residents of the city of Chicago do not believe that the housing crisis is behind us. 3 in 4 people who live in the city believe that we're still either in the middle of the housing crisis or the worst is yet to come. It's a little bit better when we look in the suburbs surrounding Chicago, but people are still really worried and they're still pessimistic. And the truth is the housing crisis has hit some residents especially hard. And those who are among the most worried that the housing crisis is not over and the worst is still yet to come are people who live in the city, but across the metro region, African-Americans and people with household incomes under $40,000 and renters also are really worried about what's to come.
Certainly. I have heard quite a bit just kind of on social media and forums as people are posting and talking about this topic. A lot of people are bringing up a lot of these points that you're talking about. But I want to back up to something that you touched on right out of the gate, and that was why is it that Chicago is hit so much harder in this housing crisis than other cities around the country?
Well, it's hard to say because we didn't look specifically at other cities, but one of the things that we found in comparison to nationally is that certainly people, I mean, everywhere, people love to live in their city, but people who live in the city of Chicago really love that, but they're paying a premium to do that. You know, the general rule of thumb is that people shouldn't spend more than 30% of their income on housing. And across the nation, we see that about 30% of people hit that threshold. But when we look in the city of Chicago, nearly half of the city's residents say that they have to pay more than 30% of their monthly income on their rent or mortgage. And housing experts call that distress for a reason. It puts a lot of pressure on families. So I think part of the reason why people are so worried about the housing crisis is it hits them and their personal lives so hard. And even in the surrounding suburbs, it's worse than nationally. People are having to dip really deep into their pocketbooks in order to afford their rent or mortgage. And that is a worse situation than what we saw nationally.
Certainly. And what would you say to, I mean, I realize we could devote an entire show to unpacking this topic in particular, but what if you had to kind of take a stab at why you see this racial disparity in terms of who is worrying more and who is hardest hit, what guess would you venture based on the data you collected on this survey?
Based on the data, I would say that it seems that we're African-Americans are living and where whites are living, their experiences are a little bit different, finding affordable housing that is also stable. So when we ask specifically what's going on in your own communities, African-Americans are more likely than whites in the Chicago area to say that it's really hard for not just low-income families with children to find affordable housing that is stable, but it's also hard for middle-income families to find. So the communities that they're living, it's harder to find that kind of housing that they need in order to have a secure, stable, middle-class lifestyle.
Certainly. And one other thing that you note in this data that I think is really interesting, and that is it seems like there is, despite a great deal of pessimism about housing affordability in Chicago, there also seems attached to it a bit of optimism that it is a solvable situation. It doesn't seem like the people that you talked to just said, well, forget it. We can't solve this. It's too hard. That's just the reality of Chicago. It does seem like there is a bit of optimism attached to it that it is highly solvable. Talk to us about that.
Right. And that is one of the really reassuring and I think important findings in this data is that Chicagoans are very optimistic that a great deal or a fair amount can be done to solve this problem, but they don't think we need to keep going on the same track. They think that something needs to change, and the status quo, frankly, is unacceptable. 4 in 5 of the Chicago area residents that we talked to say that it's important for elected leaders to address problems related to housing affordability, and that feeling is really widespread. but it's especially strong among those who have faced the greatest personal challenges. And not only that, but Chicago area residents want to hear more from the presidential candidates about what they would do to solve the problem of housing affordability. The large majority say that this issue is not getting enough attention in conversation and debate surrounding the presidential election. So there's a real appetite for to hear more and also to hear specific policy solutions. And overwhelmingly, there is quite a bit more support for policy solutions than opposition to policy solutions on the issue. We tested a number of them, and there was a great public appetite for solutions and a desire to see policymakers put forth real ideas to solve this problem.
Corey Hunt, Vice President at Heart Research, in partnership with MacArthur Foundation. Say that three times fast. You can find out a lot more about this data at MacFoundation.org. We'll be right back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us on this very lovely Saturday afternoon. I appreciate you for spending part of your day with us. Still lots to do here on the Business Lunch show. We're going to be talking a little bit later in the program about a bunch of new executives in Chicago area and how they're doing and what they're doing and new and innovative ideas that they're bringing to the table. So right now, though, we have really interesting news out of Philadelphia right now, and that is this past week, the soda tax passed. Now, this soda tax, you're familiar with it. We've been talking about it for quite a while, right? It was proposed in many cities, and it keeps getting shot down from like New York to Seattle to even here. It just hasn't done well. But suddenly, things have changed in Philadelphia just this past week. And so here to talk about that with us is Rachel Premack from Washington Post. Hi, Rachel. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Certainly. Well, so talk us through this, because it seemed like it was just this was something that kept getting defeated in city after city after city. So what changed in the last couple of weeks in Philadelphia that turned the tide and had this soda tax pass?
Well, Philadelphia had a new mayor come in, Kenny. He was elected and took office in January. And one of the things he proposed to do just this February was to pass the soda tax. And this has been actually proposed in Philadelphia twice before in the last few years, but both times it's failed. But what changed this time, why experts are saying that this tax passed this time around, was because Kenny proposed the tax not on the basis of telling people to stop drinking soda, telling them that it's unhealthy and that this tax would sort of discourage them from drinking soda, but rather the idea of the tax, the revenue would go towards universal preschool in Philadelphia. And that just sort of changed the game, I guess, of what the soda tax is all about. As Kenny said, people don't really like when people tell them, when government tells them like what to drink and what they should put in their body and whatnot, but telling them that the tax is going to help education and help community services, that totally, that's just a different motivation for the tax and makes it a little bit more palatable for people. The other difference with this tax was that instead of having this be a voter referendum, it went through City Hall. So instead of having to convince the entire city of Philadelphia that they should allow this tax, it was just 19 city council members.
Right.
So that's not typical for these taxes. And experts are saying that's like another major reason that this tax was able to pass.
Well, it does certainly. I mean, it's certainly interesting, right, that such a big shift occurred over just a matter of shifting the narrative. It's really the same thing at stake here. But what was shifted was, instead of a sense of, oh, the mayor's not going to tell me what to do, you know, shifting it to, okay, I'm willing to stomach this for such a good cause like universal preschool.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, and then, but there's, it doesn't seem like it's over because there's already people that are threatening to, that have a lot of stake in this, that are threatening to sue and to try to block this. So talk us through that part of it too.
So, whenever these taxes proposals come up in cities, there's quite a bit of lobbying from quite a bit of pushback from a range of groups. The main one, however, is the American Beverage Association. And they typically focus a lot of resources on educating the city that against the taxes, and those sort of things. So,
and when you're talking about a lot of money, I mean, we're talking about $9.1 million that they spent just in San Francisco 2 years ago to try to block this. So it's significant
yeah.
money. We're talking about big soda here, as you've referred to them
yeah.
in your story at Washington Post.
Yeah.
And so what's at stake here? Because, it you know, there's a lot of competing narratives. There's a lot of there's so much information out there. But it certainly seems like the health benefits are clear. Is the resistance really just a matter of citizens not wanting to be told what to do and saying, like, if I want to be healthy, I'm going to do it on my terms, not because I'm told to? Or is this really a necessary step to get people to just make healthier choices because they're not making them independently?
Well, a lot of the... In the Philadelphia case, a lot of the pushback from those lobbying against the tax, they were saying that this is a regressive tax because it's typically the poor and the working class who are the most likely to be buying soda. However, it's a flat tax, which is inherently regressive. So so when you tack on an extra dollar, $2 onto, or even just a few cents onto soda or sugary juices or what have you, naturally the burden falls on the poor. And that's what the soda, big soda was sort of arguing. The other argument they had was that the local grocery stores and local restaurants that sell soda, they would experience a hit in their revenues because people would not do their big grocery shopping in Philadelphia. They would just cross the border into a different city and buy the soda and iced tea and energy drinks that they would normally be purchasing.
Well, sorry to cut you off, but how much of an increase would be like, what is the reality of this increase? What would it really look like to the consumer in dollars?
So it's 1.5 cents per ounce of drinks. And for a 2 liter soda, that's an extra $1.01. For a 12-pack of soda cans, that's $2.16. And for, like, a smaller purchase, in my article, I cite the Starbucks, like, the glass Frappuccino bottles, which are only 13.7 ounces. That's 21 cents.
Okay.
So for regular drinkers this of soda and other sugary beverages, that would add up to quite a bit for their and grocery bill, I would say.
Yeah, certainly.
And originally,
go ahead.
Oh, go ahead, sorry.
No, you go ahead.
Originally, it was 3 cents per ounce, but when it was debated last week, the mayor and the city council decided it would be just 1.5 cents per ounce. So first, it would have been quite a bit higher. It would have been twice as higher, and in some cases, that would double the cost of a lot of these purchases. So, yeah.
And this is filtered over into the election narratives, too, because we have some candidates that have been weighing in on this idea of big soda and a drink tax, too. What about that?
Yeah, so Clinton and Bernie Sanders have both weighed in on this issue. Clinton is saying that, sort of taking the narrative that the Philadelphia mayor and city council are discussing, that it would support educational benefits and is overall a good idea and it's a good tax. Whereas Sanders, interestingly, is sort of saying going by the argument that the soda industry and other industries who are against this tax, he's saying that the burden would fall unfairly upon the poor. And I think and experts who are for the tax are saying, well, yeah, it does fall unfairly upon the poor, but the educational benefits, the community benefits of universal preschool and better community centers, that would also disproportionately, like, very much help the poor because they're the ones who are most likely to be using these resources or would most likely not have access to these resources typically. It is interesting that candidates are also weighing in on the issue, and they're both have different opinions on the issue. So, yeah.
And so when is this tax going to take effect in Philadelphia?
I believe it will take effect. I don't think they've quite figured that out yet.
But soon enough, I'm sure.
Yes, I think it's by the beginning of 2017. That's when the monetary benefits and revenue of the tax will start coming in. And then by 2020, I think the universal preschools will be in action and serving people.
Excellent. All right. Well, we will keep turning to you for more information as this story continues on. All about, you know, who would think that the simple product of soda would be so fraught and so complex, but indeed it is. So we'll keep turning to you. In the meantime, head to WashingtonPost.com to read Rachel Premack's story all about the latest out of Philadelphia on the soda tax. Rachel, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Certainly. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we are talking about this new crop of executives in Chicago. We're going to be checking back on a story we did a couple months ago to see how everybody is doing here in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with me. I am so grateful to you for that. But I do hope that you get outside and enjoy some of that lovely sunshine because it is super beautiful out there, and your February self will thank you for enjoying it now, that's for sure. All right, now on the program, you know, well, I want to talk about CEOs because for a long time, Chicago, we had this reputation as having these very, very stable companies with very stable leadership. And once the leader was there, they stayed there. But in the last year or two, we had a lot of changes in a lot of leadership positions in a lot of companies here in Chicago. And so you may have been kind of surprised to see us kind of shake that a little bit and change direction a bit. But here to talk with us about that and kind of give us an update about how all the new CEOs are doing that suddenly entered all of these companies from Chicago Magazine, Ted Fishman. Welcome to the show, Ted.
Oh, so glad to be with you. Yeah, it's pretty stunning, isn't it? One of the facts I learned doing this story for Chicago Magazine was that across the country and even across the world, CEOs are very stable. It's been very stable, one of the most stable times in history for the executive suite. But in Chicago, we have as much tumult as ever. It's very atypical.
Why do you suppose that is?
There's a few reasons. One of the interesting things about Chicago is that the corporate culture here has long been quite stable and kind of cozy, where there's a lot of board members of big companies who are on the boards of other companies, and they tend to support each other and give each other stability. But the kind of unexpected consequence of that is that it's made Chicago companies the target of activist investors. These are the large investors. Sometimes they're institutional investors. Sometimes they have hedge funds. They come in and they see value in a company that's not being realized. They ask for changes in the boardroom, changes in the executive suite. And when they see stability, they see opportunity, interestingly enough. So they come in and they like to break eggs.
Certainly, right. Well, so let's go company by company here and talk through, because of the, I think, 15 or 16 that saw leadership changes, we're talking about some pretty major organizations. I think
the one
that was really in the headlines a lot was United, because that was so dramatic. We see the new CEO come in. We see he quickly has a health crisis and, you know, has to take time away. And that was such a dramatic one across our headlines. How break it down for us about how the new leadership's people in the new leadership positions are doing and what changes they're bringing to these long, very stable businesses.
Well, as you know, United had gone through a fair amount of tumult itself. It had been bought by Continental Airlines. So this big hometown company suddenly had a merger partner that was from Texas, and the executives was it bought by Continental? I hope I have the right group. Anyway, it was purchased, and the executives were switched out with the executives of the acquiring company, and Jeff Smyzak came in. And you might remember Smyzak. He's the one who, when you take a United flight, he was always on the video saying, you know, we have the hardest working employees and so on, and customer satisfaction. But the truth is, people didn't like flying. It got, you know, the reputation of United got to be pretty shabby. And it was shabby for one other really, really big reason, which was that Smyzak was kind of caught in an influence scandal where he was providing a special flight to that served the New Jersey legislature so that they could get landing privileges
right
there. And, you know, he's under indictment. He could be in a lot of trouble. He was moved out, and a new CEO moved in, Oscar Munoz. And as soon as he came in, he needed some attention because he needed a heart transplant.
And it seemed like while he was out recovering from the heart transplant, was a lot of big stuff happened within his company while he was not there. And so I think that kind of led to United being such an interesting case.
That's right. Right. And so a lot of things happened when he was there, and he was wondering, like, is he going to come back? He's had the heart transplant. Does he have the steel and the stamina to run the company when he gets back? Well, it seems like he did. He did come back, and he is running the company, and it seems to be going well. And then the other kind of big celebrity Chicago company that everybody thinks about with Chicago is McDonald's.
Certainly.
And McDonald's had been having a really bad year. And interestingly enough, Chicago Magazine had done a big profile last year of Don Thompson, who was the CEO of McDonald's. He didn't have a very long tenure. He kind of came in as McDonald's fortunes were going down. And, you know, there is this thing called executive luck. It's kind of fascinating, kind of unfair, which is when you come into the executive suite, of course, you inherit a company that has a long trajectory, but you get blamed for everything that happens on your watch.
Right.
So almost as soon as Thompson got in, McDonald's numbers started going south, and the board got really restless.
Well, and it seems like McDonald's seems like a really interesting case because they also, it seems like they had put so much effort into really kind of changing their brand a lot. It seems like they wanted to appeal to more millennials, and there was a bunch of kind of competing narratives really about millennials will go to McDonald's, but they won't admit it, and they want to go to a, you know, different menu. And it seemed like there was suddenly a lot of things being discussed about McDonald's at the same time, which I have to believe kind of led to some instability.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. They had tried so many different things, drifting more towards the casual restaurant category, even trying waiter services in some of the restaurants and so on. And they had tried a lot of things. But and the investors, including activist investors who were influential on the board, started saying, hey, you know, we need some change here. We've had board members who have been board members for a long time. We've always promoted from within. Don Thompson himself had been a line cook at McDonald's, had kind of risen all the way up, and they wanted some change. So they turned to this gentleman, Steve Easterbrook, who had been very successful making some changes at McDonald's restaurants in Great Britain and in Europe. And Easterbrook came in very quickly, made this decision to do breakfast all day, which is an idea that had been batted around for years at McDonald's. And that seemed to turn McDonald's fortunes around. But I think there's an executive luck factor there, too, because the economy also turned around.
Right.
But breakfast all day has been a very big hit. McDonald's share prices went to an all-time high not long after he took the helm. And, you know, so the activist investors look smart. He looks smart. The shareholders are happy, and so on. And so once you create something like that, then people start looking on, like, what are the other companies that, you know, where we can break some eggs?
Right. Certainly. And you know what I think was interesting about that move on behalf of McDonald's that Easterbrook did was to have that, having that all day breakfast. It seems like it kicked off some kind of breakfast war, because suddenly you started seeing other fast food chains weighing in about breakfast, and some of of them, I'm thinking of Taco Bell in particular, they were pretty aggressively targeting the McDonald's breakfast products, which is really interesting. So there were soda wars back in the day, and now we're in the breakfast wars. So,
oh, that's interesting. I hadn't paid attention to that. How are they doing in that in their breakfast? How are the McDonald's competitors doing in their breakfast war?
Well, we'd have to pull some data and check that out, but it seems a bit aggressive in some of the ads, really. So it seems like the war is heating up for sure.
Yeah. I'm a fan of McDonald's breakfast, but So I kind of like it, but I hadn't thought about a breakfast taco after my beer binge
right.
at night. Maybe I should.
It seems like a lot of people did talk about when McDonald's moved to the all-day breakfast. A lot of people did quickly pair that with hangover remedies, so they must have known their target.
And now I think they should serve beer.
Wow.
Combine it. That's the next seat. The next activist.
Get it all done at McDonald's. You can just live there. All right.
Yeah. So kind of going through the list, there's McDonald's, there's Heinz, Kraft, there's a whole mess of them, and it's also shaken up all of the kind of leadership boards in Chicago and everything. So it's good. I think in the long run, it's probably a good thing. It keeps us vital. It creates dynamism in our economy. But it's not all good, because you like to have your local champions too.
Indeed. Well, maybe it's executive luck, maybe not. But thanks so much for breaking it down for us, Ted Fishman from Chicago Magazine. Everybody head to chicagomag.com to read about all of these different companies and their leadership changes. Thanks so much, Ted, for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. My friends, we're going to take a little break and get you to news and all that good stuff. We'll be back in just a bit on 720 WGN.